The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
Now is the time for us to believe in ourselves and what we can do. And that's why I am standing to be leader of the Conservative Party.
Boris Johnson began his leadership campaign in earnest this week, telling MPs he was best placed to beat Labour and put Nigel Farage back in his box. Meanwhile, his leadership rivals queued up for an audience with Donald Trump as the US president blew into town for his photo opportunity with the Queen. The contest kicks off properly next week, so is it still Boris's to lose? Also this week, it's all change at Change UK, as six of its 11 MPs depart the fledgling party. We talk to one of those sticking with it, Chris Leslie. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. And then there were 11. Early casualties of the Tory leadership race this week were Kit Malthouse and James Cleverly, who withdrew as the party agreed new rules to weed out candidates with little chance of winning. The six frontrunners, with enough declared supporters, are Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Jeremy Hunt, Michael Gove, Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. Johnson is current favourite to be anointed as Prime Minister in the week of the 22nd of July. But a month is a long time in politics. Could we be looking at Prime Minister Mordaunt or Gulp McVeigh by the summer? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Katie Balls from The Spectator and Ellie Mae O'Hagan and Raphael Baer from The Guardian. Katie, I was going to say you had a ringside seat at the hustings on Tuesday night, but you were the ringmaster at the hustings on Tuesday night. And we journalists, most of us journalists, were outside in the corridor, I'm sad to say. What was the mood like in there in the room?
Yeah, I managed to get a seat. So I was chairing the discussion and it was one by one interviews. I think the mood, it's a fairly polite atmosphere. I think ahead of it, there was some talk that Boris Johnson could be heckled. And this is because it was the One Nation caucus. So this is the group of Conservative MPs headed up by Amber Rudd and Nicky Morgan. Now, I think there are lots of Conservative MPs who would describe themselves as One Nation Conservatives.
It's quite a broad term, isn't it?
Exactly. Specifically with this group, they have their declaration of values, which relate to things like having a United Kingdom, the environment, free enterprise. But I think what they're best known for is that they don't like no deal and they are opposed to a no deal Brexit. So Boris Johnson describes himself as a One Nation Conservative, but he's also saying that he won't take a no deal Brexit off the table. So there was some view that this could be a real confrontation, but I think everyone listened to what everyone had to say. And before, you know, an hour after it had gone, it splashed on the front of three newspapers, his comments. So a lot of information did get out from the event of its own accord.
We have our sources, yeah.
I think Boris Johnson's pitch was that he wasn't going to soften his no-deal Brexit line, but he did try and play up other things that he would have in common with the MPs in the room. And I think what's really benefiting Boris Johnson right now is someone called Dominic Raab, because compared to Dominic Raab, Boris Johnson seems less right-wing to some of the MPs in the centre of the Tory party on various issues, and that's making them think that if they have to have a Brexiteer who is willing to countenance a no-deal Brexit, Boris Johnson is a less bad option than someone like Dominic Raab.
And Michael Gove, Raff, last night at the second round of these hustings, not chaired by Katie, we should say, put himself in a slightly different position again, didn't he? Said, I'm not wedded to the idea of October the 31st. So he's the sort of even slightly more sensible Brexiter, isn't that
then? Well, yeah, this has been Michael Gove's position now for some time, which is essentially the most, as it were, sort of orthodox, true believer Brexiteer up to the point of accepting no deal. So because, and I think it's for a number of reasons that he can't quite go that far and say, you know what, no deal is something we should do. Partly it is probably just because he is just a slightly more rigorous, serious thinker than some of the people who are prepared to go along with a no-deal chat. Yeah, I think he genuinely understands the hazard for the state, for the economy that would be involved in that. I think particularly the department that he was in when he was Environment Secretary just introduced him to a lot of the practical problems that go along with doing no-deal. And also he has to recognise he's a very tactical politician, and he recognises that, you know, between, I think Katie's absolutely right what she said about Dominic Raab, based carving out this space for Boris to be sort of, as it were, one row into sanity when you've got someone who's out in the aisle being completely bonkers. And that's actually quite a good position for Boris to be in. And so Michael really has to then pitch himself as, insofar as there is a centre of the Conservative Party, a unity candidate, that would be him. And I think, broadly speaking, that is at least sort of ideologically true. I mean, if you did a kind of a graph with a sort of XY axis that sort of leave on one end, remain on the other, ultra Thatcherite, you know, slash and burn, pro austerity on one axis, on one end, and sort of old style wet, invest, spend money on stuff at the other end, and did a sort of scatter plot on that axis of where all the parliamentary Tories are, you'd probably find Michael Gove pretty much in the middle of that. The problem is that being that unity candidate also means you alienate people on all the various fringes. But I think he's probably put himself in a fairly tactically astute position.
And Ellie May, talking about Dominic Raab being out in the aisle there, last night's contribution from him was that he'd be willing to prorogue Parliament, to suspend Parliament if necessary, to get a no deal Brexit through. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I mean, this is a very cliche thing to say, but I wonder what the reaction would have been if a Labour MP had said that. I mean, I feel that people would have been saying it's Stalinism. There's going to be tanks on the lawn of Parliament Square. You know, of course, proroguing Parliament is a crazy idea. And yeah, I think we should really reflect on what's going on in the Conservative Party. I think something really extraordinary is happening in that party.
That is the case, Katie, isn't it? That ideas that would have seemed incredibly fringe are now in mainstream discussion in the Tory party.
I would say on the proroguing Parliament comment by Dominic Raab, he is the minority view there when you look at all the candidates. And actually, like, a lot of people have reacted very badly to the idea you're going to prorogue Parliament. So, I mean, it is something, obviously, that you have a leadership candidate saying they would do it. But in that room, it landed very badly. And it's interesting that in the hustings I chaired, every single Brexiteer who was saying they would countenance a no-deal Brexit. So Sajid Javid, Andrea Leadsom and Boris Johnson all explicitly ruled out proroguing Parliament. So I don't think it is a majority view in the Conservative Party. Andrea Leadsom said that she'd consulted clerks at some point and had worked out that this wasn't really a viable option. Sajid Javid said that he thought Parliament had to have a say. So I think what you're seeing is, when it comes to Dominic Raab, what are the votes he is going for to try and make the final two? Now, look at the European Research Group. That is a group with probably the Eurosceptics of the party that feel the most strongly on having a clean Brexit. Now, I think by having this dividing line between himself and Boris Johnson, I think it helps Boris Johnson in many respects. I think what Dominic Raab is trying to do is pick up those European Research Group votes to try and get further in through the rounds. And he now has something to say, I am more serious about delivering no deal than my rivals.
I'd be a lot less sanguine about the talk of, even if it's only a tiny minority, even if it's just Dominic Raab and Marc Francois talking about proroguing Parliament, because, and I agree with Ellie about this, what really is happening here is this constant ratcheting of the parameters of what's a normal discussion about what you should do in this country, further and further away from things that are practical. And so when you hear talk about a sort of a global trade Brexit or a clean Brexit or a no deal Brexit, there's really no discussion of what that actually involves and what practically that means. And I mean, the reason Dominic Raab or anyone would entertain proroguing Parliament is because there is this question of, could you actually persuade Parliament? Is there some potential parliamentary obstacle to delivering no deal? And even the quite moderate or self-styled moderate candidates in this race, when they say, well, I wouldn't do no deal, when Michael Gove says, well, we probably have to get another extension, their explanation is because Parliament won't permit no deal. Now, that's a pretty cowardly way of framing it, because actually the reason not to do it is because it's a terrible, terrible idea. There's no such thing as a clean Brexit. Immediately after no deal, your whole legal system, your economy are in chaos. You're forced back into a negotiation with the EU, but from a much weaker position. It's properly bonkers. No one was seriously counselling it in 2016 or 2017. It's only landed on the agenda now. And as the sort of the framing of the debate moves, it just becomes an entirely normal thing to discuss. And when half of the field of Tory candidates are prepared to discuss that quite normally, that suggests, you know, as was just said, that the Conservative Party is in a very peculiar place right now.
Well, and part of that is because the backdrop of the discussion is what's going on in Peterborough this week, where there's a by-election and Nigel Farage's Brexit Party looks as if it might do quite well, right? That's what's in people's minds when having this discussion.
I think there is a sense that the Brexit Party, if you're going to look at the various threats to the Tory vote, the Brexit Party threat is seen as a greater threat right now than the Liberal Democrat vote. Now, it's interesting that lots of Tory candidates want to say, hey, we can actually win both voters back. I think there is scepticism as how you unite voters who have said many times they want a no-deal Brexit. They will only take that as being a Brexit that they would accept as fitting that description. And how you unite that with those Remain Conservative voters who feel very isolated by the party and are looking at the Liberal Democrats. And I think if you look at the European election results, you saw two parties do very well with very clear Brexit positions, but completely opposing. And that's a riddle for, I think, every main party when it comes to working out how to get like a big coalition of voters. I think on the Brexit party point, there is a general sense, and I think you saw this in the hustings this week, that Sajid Javid received a lot of support actually when he said the way to beat the Brexit party is by not being the Brexit party. And I think there are lots of Tory MPs who do feel that you need to deliver Brexit, but you shouldn't be going straight to the Nigel Farage playbook to do that.
Anyway, let's talk about Johnson. I was at a briefing with a Tory pollster, Lord Haywood, this week, who was saying he comes out as the most popular candidate. So he's the candidate people are most likely to kind of recognise and like. He also comes out as the most unpopular candidate. He's an incredibly kind of divisive and polarising figure, isn't he? Would Labour relish the chance of taking on Boris Johnson, do you think, at a general election?
I don't think that Labour would relish taking on Boris Johnson. Although I don't, I also think that we shouldn't underestimate Michael Gove, particularly if he's, I mean, this is total speculation on my part, but particularly if he's still in contact with his old colleague Dominic Cummings, then Labour probably will be in trouble.
Who, of course, helped run the Vote Leave campaign, was a very significant figure in the Vote Leave campaign.
Yes, and is a very talented political tactician. Boris Johnson, I think that, you know, Boris, he represents the kind of era that we're living in. I think people don't want sort of middle-of-the-road politicians. They do want politicians that are off-putting to one section of the population, but actually really, you know who they are and you know what they stand for. And Boris Johnson is styling himself as one of those politicians. I think his greatest strength and his greatest weakness is that he will do and say whatever it takes to advance himself. Now, that's obviously a strength because whatever the people want, he will offer it to them. But it's a weakness because it suggests that he's unreliable. Whether the fact that he's unreliable is, off-putting enough for people not to vote for him is another question. And I would actually add that as much as we're all looking, although I would caveat that I am alone in this, I haven't met a single person in politics or journalism that agrees with me on this, but I do believe that actually going forward, the Brexit Party is the threat, not the Conservative Party. I think the Conservative, we might be seeing end of days for the Conservative Party. And I do think they could be replaced by the Brexit Party, which sounds very extreme. And people often bring up the fact that we exist in a first-past-the-post voting system. But what I would say to that is that we did used to have two main parties, the Liberal Party and the Tory Party, and the Liberal Party was replaced by the Labour Party. So Labour supporters should know better than anybody that that system can be disrupted. And it is the Brexit Party that are speaking more to the era at the moment than the Tory Party. And I do think we're living in an era where nothing is off the table.
I think one thing I'd want to add on just on the Boris point, which I think, first of all, two things actually. One is that it's clear that what he's trying to do at this particular stage in the contest is to remind his colleagues that he was once this very affable, actually quite middle of the road, moderate person, won London two times, the liberal metropolis, usually votes Labour. I personally don't think that character is accessible to him anymore since he was the figurehead of the Leave campaign in the country. I think a lot of people and the Conservatives would wish that he could still tap into what that resource that he had then. I don't think he has. And crucially, following on from that, I think it's that there's a particular sort of parochialism and myopia in the Conservative Party, but not understanding that everything about the Boris character and the persona and the potential appeal it has is English and about England. And it just doesn't translate, as far as I understand, to Scotland and Wales. And there are seats there, and it's going to be really hard for the Conservative Party if it really embraces this essentially kind of cartoon idea, this sort of P.G. Woodhouseian leadership, sort of performance thing. It will definitely sort of tickle a certain bit of the electorate, but it's not an obvious route, I don't think, for them.
I mean, I think one of the biggest arguments against Boris Johnson is what would it mean for Scotland? And there is perhaps not the nicest name, but there's Operation Arse, which is the Scottish Conservative MP's efforts to try and keep him off the ballot paper of the final two. I don't even think it's an acronym. I think it's just a statement, a description. Perhaps of their view. And in that, you're seeing this idea that they do think that Boris Johnson would be a problem. They think it would limit the chances of actually retaining seats there. I would say there's been a slight shift there because Boris Johnson is looking more likely as a prospect. So you saw Ruth Davidson, who's been very critical of Boris Johnson, soften her opposition to him. I was speaking to Scottish Conservative MPs this week who would not put Boris Johnson down as their first choice, had no plans to endorse him, but they said they're trying to find the silver lining of a Boris Johnson premiership. And they said, the thing is, they do believe Boris Johnson would be very keen to be liked and to try and make the people of Scotland like him. So it's likely that the Scottish Conservative MPs would get a lot of things they wanted in terms of infrastructure. That they suggested that it could be
imaginary bridges, I should think.
And they also suggested that Boris Johnson would be aware enough of the problems and would perhaps give them a lot of their own space. So it would be much more Ruth Davidson's territory. He wouldn't try and do too much in Scotland. And that's nothing to do with conversations they've had. If they are having to accept the reality that it is currently Boris Johnson's to lose, how can they mitigate that in terms of the next election?
Yeah. Who else could still declare?
So the 1922 committee have changed the rules to try and keep the number of candidates down slightly. We had 13 candidates, and as you mentioned in the introduction, we've had Kit Malthouse and James Cleverly drop out. Now, others we were expecting to potentially throw their hat into the race were Steve Baker, Graham Brady. I think that's less likely now because there's a higher threshold in terms of the number of votes they need before it's just two MPs to nominate you. However, it's worth just keeping an eye on Penny Mordaunt. I think that's the only person people think might be able to say, I'm running, and have the MPs to match. I do think the problem at this stage, though, is because quite a lot of MPs have come forward and said who they're backing, you would almost need Penny Mordaunt to say, I'm launching, and here are the 10 MPs I've taken from Lee's campaigns, which is a bit of an ask, but would clearly get her quite a lot of attention and momentum.
I think also there is just this point of, it is not a great time to be taking this job. I mean, there is quite a discernible possibility that whoever wins this contest will go down in history as the shortest serving prime minister.
Yeah, there's no shortage of people coming forward, though. It doesn't seem to have deterred many people.
I know,
people
just look at the chalice and don't see the poison in it, I suppose.
Mordaunt's quite an interesting figure, Katie, isn't she? The contest would certainly look rather different if she stood.
Yeah, Penny Mordaunt's really interesting. She's kept her cards fairly close to her chest in the past couple of years. We know that she campaigned for Brexit. She drew a lot of criticism in the EU referendum campaign for her comments on Turkey. And you saw David Cameron, Prime Minister at the time, call her out for that and so forth. Since then, she's been fairly quiet in Cabinet, at least. I mean, she has made the point on Brexit, but everyone thought she would resign at so many points as Brexit got watered down.
Yeah, she was always on the list of potential resigners.
What they wanted to forget, she managed to stay in and then get this big promotion to Defence Secretary. I think that she is seen as someone who has the potential to appeal to centre voters if she were to go for it. But I do think the problem is lots of these campaign teams have been planning this for, you know, a year, perhaps even more. And if you haven't done that, you need to really know that you have those numbers in terms of the MPs. And I don't know if her campaign is there right now.
Yeah, and then the deadline's very, very close. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, the future looked bright for Change UK, then called The Independent Group, back in February, when MPs including Heidi Allen, Chuka Ramunna, Sarah Wollaston and Anna Soubry split from their respective parties and pledged to work together to fight Brexit. Just 4 months on, and 6 of its 11 MPs have departed, following a disappointing performance in last month's EU elections, when it failed to get a single MEP elected. On the phone now, I have one of those MPs sticking with Change UK, Chris Leslie. Chris, Tell us what happened. The group launched with such kind of fanfare and with all these defections from Labour and the Tories, and now you're down to only five of you.
Well, look, we are sticking with it. And the thing I think we've all learned is that changing British politics and trying to, you know, challenge the established parties is not an easy task. That might sound like an understatement, but we've learned that there are a lot of things about when you actually try and enter the field and give the public a choice. It's quite a sort of cartel, really, between the big parties. The rules are very strict about what you can call yourselves, the way in which you're branded, and not just that, but also the airtime that you have. You know, there's no rules on debates and those kind of things. So it's a really hard slog for new parties. And it's why I think when we said politics is broken, we've got to change it, it's certainly come home to me that there are a lot of things that have got to change. We wanted to not just leave our parties, but also give the public a choice. There's no point me sort of moaning and groaning about the state of politics on the back benches. I think we had to be there ready to stand for elections. And that, obviously, the story then goes what happened with the European elections and the difference of views thereafter between the MPs.
And that was the main point of difference, was it? Because, as you say, there were practical challenges, but there were evidently also, you know, clashes of personality or of views, weren't there, between the members of the group?
Well, I mean, I think we do share values. I think there was some tactical disagreements, and principally about whether to stand candidates and whether to vote for our flag, for our standard, and to hold it up. And as Heidi Allen said in some interviews subsequently, you know, she was of the view that she didn't particularly want to be asking people to vote for Change UK, especially in the last week of the campaign. Now, you can imagine that wasn't the majority view of the MPs. But
it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, to set up a party
and persuade all these candidates to
stand and just a few weeks
exactly.
later to say, please don't vote for us.
And I'm trying to be as diplomatic as I can. But you can imagine that was quite a heated discussion. My view is that if you've got principles and values, you need to be able to defend them. When people attack you, you need to be able to fend off those attacks. When falsehoods are said about you, you need to be able to rebut those. And of course, I think some of our colleagues, you know, particularly with the Liberal Democrats, wanted to be very nice and polite, even to the extent of not responding to things that were self-evidently wrong. For instance, this idea that there was some offer of a deal or on seats or wherever, when that was just not the case. But, you know, in a way, I think there's a long haul view of this, which is, politics is tough. It's difficult to break into. Do you continue to fight and try your best, or do you sort of step back and retreat and say it's impossible to do that? I just can't bring myself to say the latter.
And do you think those of your colleagues who've now left may ultimately end up as Liberal Democrats? Are they on that path, do you think?
They may well be. And, I we've agreed that we're going to be friends and keep trying to partnering and working together. And, you know, we want to do that with the other parties, of course. I just myself can't, you know, leave the Labour Party, set out my views and then say, oh, well, I'll go to one of the established parties. It's the only way to be. I'll pretend to be a liberal Democrat in that sense. Well, you know, I do share some of their values, certainly do on Brexit. But there are other issues, national security, social policy questions to do with law and order and crime and punishment, those kind of things, where I don't share their views. And I think what we need in the centre ground is respect between the distinct three strands, centre-left social democrat, and there's a lot of people in the Labour Party who are utterly fed up of what's going on with Corbyn. Yes, the liberal tradition, but that one nation conservative tradition as well. Now, of course, there are disagreements between those. If we can respect those and work together, I think that's the way to do it. But it doesn't mean all having to merge into one political party.
Chris Leslie, thank you very much. Chris Leslie there. Ellie May, was Change UK doomed from the start, do you think?
Yes, it was doomed from the start. But I don't blame them as individuals. And I think we should move away from the argument that they're incompetent as politicians. That's not what's going on. I think the reason that it was doomed from the start is if you went to any one of their events, which I did, you would have been watching a form of politics that acted as though there wasn't a giant meltdown of the global economy in 2008, which led to the stagnation of wages for 10 years, or there wasn't 9/11, you know. We've lived through an era of 20 years of massive political change. And they were trying to embody a form of politics that really just doesn't exist anymore and has no cachet anymore. And so for me, their incompetence stems from that fact. It stems from the fact that they didn't know how to do politics in the current era that we live in. And that's why you see all of these kind of madcap ideas coming out of them, like, we're not going to have any policies, we're just going to go to the pub and hang out, you know, we're going to go to Nando's. Yeah, we're not going to have a leader, we're all going to sort of contribute together to what our eventual manifesto is going to be, you know, we're not going to have political colors. And it's all a very sort of surface level way of trying to say we're different, we're not like the others, we represent change, when actually what they wanted was to revert to a form of politics that has died.
Do you think that's right, Rafa? There was something slightly retro about it, but it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because these were people who believed that they were very good at politics.
Yeah, I think that captures, certainly stylistically, very much that sense that it all felt like, in terms of the way it was projected, it did feel a bit of a kind of going through a sort of mid-90s sort of centre-liberal political playbook. I'd separate that out from this point of not necessarily having policies. I mean, the Brexit Party famously doesn't really have policies or a manifesto or an organisation, and they've done phenomenally well. And I think where Ellie May's absolutely right, though, is the tactical misjudgment that the Change UK people made. There were two very important, separate to the personality issues, which I'm sure were a factor as well. I mean, if you form a party from people who generally don't get on with other people in their party, there's always the possibility they won't get on with each other as well. But just parking that, the two tactical misjudgments they made were strategic problems, which were calculations, where one, I think people at the top of that organisation really strongly thought that we would end up leaving the EU on the 29th of March, and that there would be a moment where there was a significant enough conspicuous betrayal by the Labour leadership of its members and voters that would be a massive recruitment drive for a new politics, but also that something that would change UK by that stage would then be in a sort of post-Brexit crisis. Mm,
the original plan was to launch after Brexit, wasn't it?
Exactly. So they really, really thought you were going to have a horrible, messy Brexit 29th of March. That turned out to be wrong. That wrong-footed them. And then the other calculation they made related to that was the Lib Dem brand was completely toast. There was no point, and they would speed off down the road and they would just be able to pull over the bus by the Lib Dems and go, you're getting on board or what? And then drive on. And actually, that also literally turned out not to be true. And I think they were quite sort of reasonable gambles, but they just put it all on one side of the, you know, their hand wasn't as good as they thought it was, or they put it on red and it came up black, whatever. And so once the European election process came through, and then there were all the other little presentational problems, organisational problems, not having a grassroots movement that you could literally have databases, have people to get people out on polling day, it was a bit of a kind of perfect storm that sort of blew them off the, you know, out of contention, really. But I still think the individuals involved deserve credit for standing up and saying the parties that we are in now represent things that we cannot stomach and put up with and have become to us completely appalling. And a lot of voters will share that feeling. I think a lot of voters do share that feeling. And therefore, we cannot in good conscience stay in these parties and say that these leaders, you know, should be prime minister. And for that, you know, I kind of still give them credit.
They did have a crap logo, though, didn't they, Katie?
The logo was pretty bad. And I think you actually noticed how bad the logo was when they put it on a bus.
Yeah. It reminded me of Huel. You know Huel, yeah. The energy drink? It reminded me of Huel.
Yeah. When they changed their name, I think that was an error. I think Tiggers
was the independent group, weren't
they? Tiggers was quite sweet sounding. It was what everyone agreed from independent group. And I don't think it was planned, but sometimes I think you can overplan things. And actually, you got the sense that with the logo and the new name, Change UK, that had a lot of consulting and big ideas. And I think it just didn't feel very organic. I think one of their problems was they did just sound a little bit arrogant. So when you went into this EU elections and they said they're not going to do this, you know, agreement or non-aggression pact with the Lib Dems.
They thought they were going to beat the Lib Dems.
And other pro-EU parties. I do think it was a bit naive and it was a bit arrogant. I think that just didn't do them any favours. And then obviously later on they tried to change tack. But I think there were a few areas, which was what was strange about it was a lot of people wanted to write the story that this was an embarrassing, you know, aim at a centrist party, I think. There were comedy situations to be had when they first launched. But in that first week, they managed to do fairly well. They managed to defy, I think, some expectations.
They got a lot of attention.
But despite that, it all seemed to go downhill quite quickly.
I think I wouldn't rule out the possibility that, I don't think Change UK is going to become a titanic force in British politics. But, you know, going back to what Ellie May was saying earlier, you know, that Brexit is a kind of meltdown in the reactor core at the heart of British politics. And, you know, you could have a Conservative leader who more or less behaves in a way that forces actually a significant number of Conservative MPs to no longer want to be part of the Conservative Party. It's still quite possible that there will be a moment when there are still a significant number of Labour MPs who could not run as Labour candidates if the proposition was Jeremy Corbyn should become Prime Minister. And they're being very quiet and they're very, very anxious and they don't know what to do about it. But they are still there and they are still MPs. So we haven't finished this sort of the cycle of realignment, reorganisation of the way British politics works and how that fits in party identities and in through this rigid first-past-the-post structure that we have. So this will, I mean, they might, Change UK might be kind of a footnote in that story, but it is part of an ongoing story.
And we should say, too, that the Lib Dems' success at the Euros has been a driving force in Change UK spitting. They've got a leadership contest going on too, haven't they, Ellie May? How's that going to go?
Well, it looks like Jo Swinson is the front runner. I think we'll see how that goes. Personally, as your listeners may or may not know, I'm a Labour supporter and I'm sympathetic.
They might have noticed that, Ellie May.
I hide it well. I'm sympathetic to the Corbyn leadership. I would be quite happy for Jo Swinson to be, from that point of view, to be the leader because, yes, on a superficial level, she's like, first of all, she's a woman, which is refreshing. She's like good in the media and stuff, but she has supported all of the policies that I think are not popular anymore.
Because she was a minister in that coalition government.
Yes, she supported austerity policies. She doesn't really, so, you know, I keep saying this, but we're living in an era of ecological breakdown, of massive inequality, of stagnation of wages, of looming automation. We're living in an era that has massive existential challenges to it. We are living in an era of extreme public anger. And we need a party that can respond to that in some ways. I think the Brexit Party can do that in a terrible way, but it can do that. I think Corbyn's Labour can do that. I think Jo Swinson offers more of the same. And I think that when she becomes leader and, you know, she scrutinised more, and I think in a general election, that would become apparent. So I actually feel quite relaxed about her becoming Lib Dem leader. I think she'll get a poll bounce. I think that a lot of Remainers will like her. But I think I have faith that the British public vote in general elections based on a range of issues. And I think she won't be able to escape from being more of the same because that's what she is.
Will the Tories be a bit worried about the Lib Dems, do you think, Katie? They did well at the council elections, didn't they, in a lot of sort of Remain Tory areas, or those places like Worthing?
Yeah, I think a lot of Conservative MPs are worried about the Lib Dems, and you've seen that so far in the leadership race. You have candidates like Matt Hancock really pushing the idea that this idea of just chasing after Brexit Party votes is mistaken, because to win, you need to have a wide range of supporters, and that would include Lib Dem voters. And I think the EU election suggested that they would lose in some of those areas and those seats in London that they currently hold. I mean, there's also questions about, when we're talking earlier about the problems of Boris Johnson, one problem is, would he hold his seat in a general election? At the moment, it's predicted that he would potentially lose his seat because it would be very divided over Brexit. Some votes would go to the Lib Dems. So I think the Liberal Democrats is a factor there. I just think that the Brexit puzzle is so hard to solve. It's very hard to see how the Tories retain both. So I hope they can. And also on Ellie's point, I do think we might be about, whenever we do get that general election, we might be about to get the Brexit election we didn't get last time. But it is unpredictable because,
depending on when it comes, I guess.
Yeah, in 2017, the Tories wanted a Brexit election. They wanted to make the whole thing about Brexit and try and get a big majority so Theresa May could basically do what she wanted. And instead, it was domestic issues that became the main talking point, crime and lots of things, dementia tax. So it's very hard to predict what the main factors are. I do think that Brexit's come to such a point now, if it is an election soon, it could well benefit the Lib Dems if they have the clearest pro-EU position.
I think it is the case generally that the Lib Dems in a sense, it's sort of a kind of normal service resumed for the Lib Dems, that it might just be midterm. They're the place that a lot of people go to when they like neither Labour nor the Tories. And in the general election, as it were, a lot of those voters go home. The one sort of caveat I think it's important to add to that is, you know, on Ellie May's point about anger, there are a lot of people who are very angry about Brexit and are very angry with Jeremy Corbyn for essentially sort of abetting the Brexit process, either just sort of as a passive passenger or a lot of people would say in a slightly more nefarious way. You know, opinion is divided on what his actual motivation is in all of this. But nonetheless, that segment of voters, I mean, I saw some polling on this just yesterday that, you know, around half of the European election Labour to Lib Dem switchers say they will stick with the Lib Dems in the general election. Now, obviously anything could happen, but that's a significant enough volume that it suggests that there's a segment of people who will basically are more, it'll be more important to them, more urgent for them in their ballot box decision that the Lib Dems and Joe Swinson are a party of Remain than that Joe Swinson and Lib Dems were once the party of coalition with the Tories. And if that's a more animating force, that is a big problem for Labour. But I think it's still a bigger...
It matters a lot when that election comes, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
At what point in the sort of Brexit car crash it occurs, I guess.
Actually, surprisingly, I would kind of agree with you. You might not expect me to do that, but I think it does depend when an election comes. I think that's a huge... I guess the reason why I was saying I think the British public will vote on a range of issues is because I don't expect the Tories to call a general election anytime soon because I think they're too worried that they would lose it. But I actually do agree that Labour does need to come out decisively in favour of a second referendum now. I mean, in the European elections, only 45% of Labour members voted Labour. I think there is no clearer signal. Their members are telling them something. There is no clearer signal that they need to back a second referendum now. I don't know if I believe them, these voters for the Lib Dems, when they say they'll stick with them. Not because, that's not me being Panglossian about the whole thing. It's just that I think you can't really believe in this volatile era.
In this moment, yeah.
Yeah, what people are saying in polls, I don't think they quite know. And I think because of the public anger, they're liable to change. However, I do think that Labour members were giving the leadership a message in the European elections. They were saying, we need you to back a second referendum. Labour is nothing without its mass membership. It's nothing without its grassroots. And I am not in favour of a second referendum on a personal level. I would rather leave with a soft Brexit and move on as a country. However, I think that, you know, it's likely to become policy in Labour conference in September anyway. Jeremy Corbyn cannot be seen to be forced into it by his party. He needs to take the lead. There is no way out now, and Labour just need to back a second referendum.
Interesting. We shouldn't let this week pass without mentioning the Donald, should we, who's been in town. Raph, we got the usual sort of rogue tweeting about Sadiq Khan and, you know, flip-flopping about the NHS and where there was a bit of a protest, or there wasn't quite as big as last time he swung into town. Has he kind of slightly lost his power to shock, do you think?
I think, sadly, yes. I think from what struck me most really about this visit is how, you know, and you need some special kind of horrified font to apply to this word, but how normal it really was. I mean, it was a state visit by a president, and there was this kind of horrendous, sort of in your peripheral vision, you were aware of just how appalling and horrendous the Trump presidency is in so many ways. But actually, for him at least, what could be transmitted back to his domestic audience, which is the only thing he really cares about, it was the full honour that the British state can afford applied to a president as it would have been done for any of his predecessors. And, you know, with the fact that there was sort of below the table tweeting that, upset people, I think in the big picture really is neither here nor there. And that, again, it's, goes back to what I was saying earlier, I think, about this sort of ratchet effects that you very quickly, you have to work hard to stay shocked, because otherwise it does all become quite a normal situation that this man, this president who has essentially a tyrannical temperament, is hostile to the institutions and the norms and conventions of liberal democracy, is the United States president.
And Ellie May, Jeremy Corbyn went to the protest against Trump, made a speech about, kind of abhorring his values and so on. It emerged at the press conference that his team had asked for a meeting with the president, which the president had turned down. Is that the right approach? He didn't go to the state banquet, of course, because he didn't feel the red carpet should be rolled out for such a president. Was it the right thing to do to ask to meet him?
Yeah, I think he's going to be prime minister. So, he should be meeting the president. They're going to have to work together. And I think... a sort of mixed approach of meeting him to figure out what each side is going to think of the other, plus a strong statement that the values that Donald Trump represents are not the values that the Labour Party shares, is pretty much the only way forward, I think, really.
And Katie, the leadership candidates were kind of quite keen to have his imprimatur, weren't they? And he certainly seemed to have met Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt got sent to the airport to meet him, and he sort of mentioned Jeremy Hunt favourably in his press conference. Does that help? Does that hinder a leadership candidate?
I think it probably helps in some sense in terms of getting through the MPs, because Boris Johnson, we knew, was someone that Donald Trump has spoken very positively about. So I think there was a sense that if Donald Trump also spoke positively about you, you're on the radar. I've interviewed Jeremy Hunt for the new issue of The Spectator, and he does speak about
quick
spending...
Quick plug there.
get in. does speak about spending a lot of time with Trump and meeting him off the plane. And he's left waiting for a while when Air Force One lands, and he presumes Donald Trump is busy powdering his nose, and said he's just aggressively tweeting about Sadiq Khan, which he is told as soon as he gets off the plane. But, I mean, I think it was interesting because Sadiq Khan aside, and clearly was very rude about Sadiq Khan, Donald Trump was much more polite than his last visit in terms of Theresa May. But the biggest burn in terms of the Tory leadership contest was Michael Gove. You had this press conference where he said Boris Johnson would be a good prime minister, he thought, Jeremy Hunt. And then he said he didn't know who Michael Gove was and asked Jeremy Hunt for his advice on the matter. And everyone was reminded that Michael Gove and Donald Trump have met. Michael Gove did an interview of him and they took a photo together back when Michael Gove was in the wilderness on the back benches. So I think that was probably the biggest Donald Trump burn of the leadership contest.
Quite possibly unintentional. I mean, you always have to factor in the possibility that he literally didn't remember that and is actually quite stupid.
Yeah. I think it was
almost certainly unintentional.
Completely unintentional, which perhaps is why it's more wounding.
Yeah, only time will tell whether Michael Gove can recover from that terrible snub. Okay, thanks everybody. Thanks very much. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Katie Balls, Ellie Mae O'Hagan, Raphael Bear and Chris Leslie. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.